fille dans mon comic strip. Viens faire des bulles, viens faire des
whip,
des
clip, crack,
des
bang,
des
bump,
et des
zip, shabam, pow, flop, whiz.
Je distribue les swings et les uppercuts. Ça fait
vlam,
ça fait
splash,
et ça fait
stop,
ou bien
bang,
ou parfois même
shabam, pow, flop, whiz.
Viens petite fille dans mon comic strip. Viens faire des bulles, viens faire des
whip,
des
clip, crack,
des
bang,
des
bump,
et des
zip, shabam, pow, flop, whiz.
Viens avec moi par-dessus les buildings. Ça fait
whiz
quand on s'envole, et puis
cling.
Après quoi je fais
tilt,
et ça fait
boing, shabam.
Comic strip, viens faire des bulles, viens faire des
whip,
des
clip, crack,
des
bang,
des
bump,
et des
zip, shabam, pow, flop, whiz.
N'aie pas peur, bébé, agrippe-toi, je suis là,
crash,
pour te protéger,
shack,
ferme les yeux,
crack,
embrasse-moi,
slack, shabam.
CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Ink Stud Show, the radio show where we talk about what? Comics. There we go. There, your mic's on.
Comics.
There we go. That was Serge Gainsbourg with the most talented, wonderful Brigitte Bardot doing Comic Strip Man. And, you know, all these years of doing the show, 2.5 years now, over 100 interviews. Never actually got that song requested, so I'm very excited to actually finally play it. Our guest this week is Françoise Moulet. Did I get it right? Moulet or Moulet?
Yes. Hi, Robin.
And she is the mastermind, I guess. Is that the phrase for today of Toon Books as well?
Editorial director is how we politely put it.
The editorial director and as well extraneous history with comics with Raw Magazine. Little Lit and other marvelous comic things, and art director for the New Yorker.
Art editor.
Art editor. Look at this.
That's how we politely put that.
So thank you for joining us today. I know you are a very, very, very busy person, so I appreciate taking the time to...
aren't we all? But yes, it's a pleasure to be with you.
So I guess we'll start by talking about Toon Books. Your latest endeavor into the comics world. What was the idea behind Toon Books, the children's aspect of it, I guess?
Yes, the Toon Books are actually about to be released, but they've been 10 years in the making. And what they are is high-quality comics for young children, not just comics for kids, but for very young kids, and specifically at the time where they enter school, and the big task ahead of them is for them to learn to read. And the impetus for this came from personal experience, because when our kids were at that stage, and they're both very bright kids, wonderful children, surrounded by books, surrounded by comics. Our daughter was 4 years older when the teacher said in January, by April, you have to know how to read, April, first grade. Lo and behold, a little light bulb went off and she knew how to read. And with our son, it took much, much longer. And longer of what? It's not a matter of drilling him. It's just a matter of like continuing to read night after night after night. And I read in French because I speak French to my kids. And Art had been reading to them all of the great works of literature for children. And I found very quickly that not only I was running out of books, but I, in order to hold my son's attention for the weeks and months that ensued, comics were perfect. And because for a very simple reason, there's something for the kid to look at while mom or dad is reading. There's a visual narrative, a mm-hmm. visual flow that carries them through. And it took months, but eventually that little light bulb went off, and Dash is now a very avid reader, and, you know, so it's a good ending to the story. But when that happened about 10 years ago, I realized, oh, my God, this is a magic bullet in a world where there are very few. As artists put it, comics are a gateway drug to literature. And there's not enough comics for kids, so I got grabbed by another messianic mission in the world, which was to make sure there would be more and good comics for kids at that age.
Well, it's quite fascinating because you've gone from doing Raw Magazine 28 years ago now, I guess, which was specifically geared at adults.
Well, the first issue came out in 1980, so, but, you know, it's been doing stuff in that field for 2-3 years before that, so ever since I met Art, yeah. So it feels like 30 years or more. But what's interesting to me is that when I discovered the field is when I met Art, who was at the time doing Arcade in San Francisco with Bill Griffiths. It was the answer to all my prayers. It was something that I thought had the highest literary qualities and artistic qualities, but was in a popular culture medium and was accessible to all. And to me, that was such a winning combination that I was never able to look back on the stuff I was doing at the time, which was studying architecture. I dropped out of the Beaux-Arts in Paris and devoted myself to publishing comics, and good comics. Because mm-hmm. it's not, you know, if, when I've been taken to task is if I go around and saying that, you know, that we have to discriminate in the same way that we do with literature, with art. It's not because it's written words that it's necessarily literature, mm-hmm. And it's not because it's comics that it's necessarily a work of art either. But it is.
It's the strength of the whole.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And you know, it's one of the in art's wonderful summary phrasings. I did do everything I could to make real the ideas that comics, they weren't just for kids anymore back in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And it's ironic for me that 30 years later, the need that I felt and what I'm doing now says, hey, comics are not just for adults anymore.
No, and it's interesting because it is definitely something that in the milieu of the comic world, a lot of people, it's gotten to such a, I guess, alienating aspect for children that it's so focused on from the mainstream to being, you know, superhero power fantasies to the alternative being very art-based. And so kids kind of got left out at some point.
Yeah, I think they actually really did get left out in a way that's too bad. On one end, because, yes, it was a very legitimate desire on the part of artists to escape from the ghetto of children literature. You know, they didn't want to be thought of as doing work just for kids. I remember talking to Jeff Smith at the time when I was just starting with this idea of doing books for young kids, and Art and I wanted to arrange something with Scholastic to do the Toon books, what has become the Toon books. And one of the issues for Jeff, it's like, well, I don't want to be published by Scholastic. He was doing fine publishing himself. What did he need? Children's book publisher. And, you know, you know the rest, obviously.
Yeah. He changed his mind at some point.
Well, no, he didn't change his mind. Even Scholastic, who had actually turned down Bones when it had been offered to them, when we showed them the line of books that we wanted to work on, they decided to pluck out the part that they felt was commercial, which was Bones, and turned their back on the rest of it, and then published it in format that made it accessible to kids. And, you know, Jeff, who was doing 100,000 copies himself as a self-publisher, was able to see those numbers multiplied by 10 and more. There's a huge audience. When it works, I was talking to Heidi McDonald last summer when we were at MoCA, and the point she made is well taken, is when you slow down to think about it, it's insane not to do comics for kids, because even from a commercial point of view, when it works, it really works. If you look at Tintin throughout the world, Donald Duck, so all of the other cultures in France, in Italy, in the European countries, in Japan, in Korea, and whatever, there's very healthy comics industries that do not cut the kids out. That's where they start. That's where you have to start.
I started with Asterix.
Yes, exactly. You know, I think here in the U.S., it is the other side of the coin of the prejudices that kept publishers or anyone from publishing, you know, the Charles Burns and Gary Panthers and Sue Coe and Lorenzo Mattotti and Yul Swat that we published in a row. We did it because nobody else was doing it, and nobody was doing it because there was such strong prejudice against comics. And now that comics have acquired a certain kind of legitimacy, I ended up having to publish myself to do kids' books and comics for kids, because when I had gone to all the mainstream children's book publishers, they still had residual fears about publishing comics.
What makes the difference between children's books and comic books?
It's a good question. I have had to ponder it. You know, I was very surprised because, hey, you publish, I went to publishers and said, you publish hundreds and hundreds of picture books. I mean, and I'm, you know, proposing to you, I had some of the books made already, books that seem very similar. What's your reservation? No, and I understood a lot of the differences when I saw them trying to repackage what I was giving to them. To follow the way they do picture
their
books.
Kind of branding.
Yeah, it seems like
it's actually, it really goes to the core. I mean, the only similarity between a picture book and a comic book is pretty much that both have pictures. And then after that, it's completely different. The core of a picture book, as published by your mainstream publisher for a young child, you know, 4 to 6, is a paragraph of text or text that is sent to them that they look at and decide upon, regardless of the pictures. It has to make sense to them. In order for them to buy a book, even if you want to send them a book proposal, they don't want to see the pictures. So that makes it impossible for comic strips to even be bought in that process, and that's why they haven't published anything. A lot of what the publishers are publishing now, the mainstream publishers, is things that have been developed in the laboratory of the Raw magazine, of the Jeff Smith, of the independent comics market. You know, they have not nurtured, or they have not even allowed a way for comics to happen, because they were, again, looking at, even when they turned to cartoonists to do children's books, they would 90% of the time pair them as illustrator of somebody else's text. And, you know, I saw that with an artist who I published for the first time. He had never been published before, Ian Falconer, on the cover of The New Yorker. And at the time Ian got the call, which most of the artists I publish on the cover, if they don't have it yet, will then get a call from a publisher saying, do you want to do a kid book? So they very eagerly go over to see the children's book publisher, who then says, like, here's the story and what we would like you to do illustrations for this. At which point they often say what Ian said to the publishers that approached him, which is, well, I'm not that interested in illustrating somebody else's story, but I have my own kid book. Would you like to take a look at it? And he was turned down because that's not the way they were doing things at the time. You know, they weren't buying books from visual artists. The long and short of the story is that one publisher, Simon & Schuster, had the good idea of actually publishing Ian's own book, the one that he had in mind, for which he had the pictures and not quite the text yet. He had it in his head, but he hadn't typeset it yet. And it became the most beloved, adored book of children's book publishing in the past few years. It's the Olivia books. But it's a telling tale because it shows you that they weren't exactly encouraging artists to do books. So when I came around and I said I want to do specifically books of comics, they were saying, well, as long as we can make the text fit within those guidelines, and the guideline, and, you know, why don't we have somewhere our Newbery-winning authors get involved and so on and so forth. And I had to explain, no, what I'm looking for is very different than
it's
a picture book.
Taking away from the original vision, I guess.
Entirely, yeah. Kind of gutting it. Because my realization, even spending time with my son and, you know, reading comics, is the reason comics are so good to draw kids into books is that they have a narrative flow that's immediately, intuitively visible. Like, kids are visually literate, and at an age where they need to be drilled about phonics and sight words and whatever, you don't need to teach them how to find Waldo. They'll find it long before you do. They have an intuitive understanding of picture language. And the flows, they will, without having to suffer, a lot of the conventions that we're trying to instill in them will come from simply looking at the comics. They'll go from left to right, top to bottom. Now, that sounds simple to you and I because we know how to read, but it's actually very counterintuitive to a young child, especially because up till that age, the kid has been mostly using trial and error. Doing things with the left hand or the right hand or with her foot or whatever, till it works. And there's no right or wrong way to do things and to learn up till the point where you get in school. And when becoming literate is actually a narrowing of the way you can learn things because it only works from left to right and top to bottom and with that specific set of rules. And that's why kids don't need to be taught video games or even computer skills, because it allows for a lot more trial and error. And visual literacy is way ahead of word literacy. And when you combine the two with the hook being the visual flow of the story, as you have in a comic, you draw them into a medium that is theirs and is a book. They get to turn the page, they get to reread, they get to make the story happen in their head. They do all the things that are magical about reading and being deep into books. And it actually leads them to want to make their own comics because they realize it's made by one person. I mean, it's really an incredible silver bullet. I mean, it really goes to the core of what you want, the kind of experience you want kids to have, and that the grown-ups are desperately trying to tell them about it, but, you know, being told about something and experiencing it firsthand, one works a lot better than the other.
Francoise, a lot of the subject matter in Little Lit is kind of dark, like some of the cartoonists, such as Charles Burns. They make quite haunting, dark images, and I'm wondering, like, how do you select what kind of material would be suitable for children to read?
Well, you make a point specifically about Little Lit, and it's true. It really is true. Like, Little Lit is for kids of all ages. In that sense, we did something that's never been done in Little Lit in the kids' book world, which is that we fought our editors tooth and nail. We're working with Joanna Cutler at HarperCollins, which is saying, you know, we have things like 4-6, 6-8, 8-12, and up, and it's for a reason because kids are at different levels of development. In Little Lit, we did work that was entirely sincere, meaning that it wasn't tongue-in-cheek and it wasn't deconstructing fairy tales or it wasn't mocking children's book medium, as Artigan was calling it, the new sincerity, the only answer to ironic deconstructions that has become somewhat tedious at this point because
there's only so far you can pull something apart.
Well, not just that, but also it presumes that the child is already media savvy. And yes, it's true that the 12-year-old is media savvy, but if you did your job right as a parent, your 6-year-old shouldn't be media savvy. And, you know, before you can deconstruct Little Red Riding Hood, how about reading Little Red Riding Hood or getting the story firsthand before you mark it? And there's that age where it's wonderful to have stories. So the Little Lit, for example, we did, the first one was folklore and fairy tale, and we asked some artists to tell well-known tales, and some artists chose less well-known tales, but they were all good, solid core stories. David Mazzucchelli did a story from Japan.
That was gorgeous.
Did a story from Estonia. I mean, they're really, like, memorable, wonderful stories again. And in Little Lit, there was a range. And it was true that, you know, some of the younger kids had to move faster over certain pages that they found, like the Charles Burns spread. I don't think too many 4-year-olds spend time with it because it is black and white. And
I was saying that it probably scares some children too.
Some do, yeah. And then others spend time at different moments in their development. The thing about kids is that they move so fast through all those stages. So one of the best feedback I got was a father, for example, who told me that the Little Lit book saved his life, which may be slightly an exaggeration of how he felt. But what he explained is that he had been recently divorced and he was traveling all summer with his 3 kids, bumming around all over Europe. So he couldn't carry that many books. So he took the 3 Little Lits with him, and he had a 4, 6, and 8-year-old. And what he did is that every night at dinner, so he would be in a different restaurant in a different country, and the kids would sit down, and one of the kids in turn would choose a story in a Little Lit, and that's a story that they would read and act out and play and talk about. And it lasted him the whole summer, and it was great for all 3 kids.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, that was wonderful. So that's what we meant by Little Lit. But with the Toon books, because we're doing a more conventional thing and because we want to really present stories for that child, the stories in the Toon books can be read to a toddler. You know, it's perfect books to take the kid on your lap and read to them, and they can follow the visual. Almost all of it is dialogue and speech balloons, and the kids very readily will want to act them out. But they also specifically tailored for kids at 6 or 7 years old and is just learning to read as some of the books that the kid will start reading on their own. Because it's a very crucial moment. If it's too easy, the kids get bored. If it's too hard,
and
the
they
kids
can't
get
into
discouraged.
It. Yeah. That interests me as far as like how, like, just finding out what kids are into. How do you figure that out? Because some people will specifically do a product for kids and it just fails. It's just not hitting the mark. But then you've got something like Jeff Smith, who does this wonderful story that he wants to tell and also happens to be fantastic for children.
Yeah, certainly Jeff's way is perfect, but it's, you know, that's the best possible way is when the artist is true to himself or herself, and then the audience finds him. And there's plenty of grown-ups that read Bourne without ever thinking of it as beneath them or juvenile literature. So it's better when you don't have to dilute your work. But we couldn't quite go about it because of the constraints that I imposed upon it, wanting to do something where a child will be reading it by herself or by himself. I had to pay attention to the vocabulary, so I worked with the artists that were willing to go through this rigorous discipline, and first they wrote the story that they wanted to write, and then we got it as perfect as a story as we could. And then we did a rough draft, and I went over it with teachers that were phenomenal, that really know that phase of development with the kids. And also I went to schools and I read it with first and second graders. And because the teachers were terrific in terms of giving me feedback on the vocabulary and saying this word is a sight word, you can use that instead of this one, which is harder to read, and this one you need to give a visual clue. So there's an enormous work done to translate in a way with accessible specific building blocks, the words themselves, the story once it was written. And then there was also work that I did back and forth with the artist in terms of the visual storytelling. I specifically went to schools where the kids had never seen comics before because my children are not good test cases because they're so overprivileged. You know, parents who just drown in books and just, you know, shower them with books, read to them, and so on.
I could
on
only imagine the collection.
Yeah. The art, as you said, like, sacrificed his comic book collection to fatherhood. And but I wanted to do books that could be read by children who had never seen comics and frankly, hadn't been read to, because that's the case with most kids. And to see whether they were, of all the millions of conventions that we use in comics, whether they were intuitively readable or whether there were some that were, you know, too confusing. Because that's also a mistake that I think many people make when they do stuff for kids, and the breakdowns are too complex.
Mm-hmm.
It's fine for, again, if you're talking about the 12-year-old, there's a very fine line, and it's one more of subject matter between the literacy level of a 12-year-old and of an adult. You know, the same way that you will have a kid figuring out how to do a my Facebook page quicker than an adult, the kids can figure out and read, you know, fairly complex comics at this point. But if you're showing this to a young child who hasn't gone through a linear narrative, hasn't read books, hasn't been read to, you need to present something that is so clear and precise. So all our books were worked on from the beginning, once we had the story, with certain unity of time and place. We actually work them out differently. We have levels, you know, because, again, it moves so fast with the kids. So we have some simpler ones, some middle ones, and some more complex ones. But certainly in the simpler ones, there's a very straightforward, almost proscenium stage where you have, it's like a puppet show. You have a little characters, and they come, and they say this thing, and they go. And there's not like 6 days passing between one moment and the next. And I worked with the artists throughout the process, and that's why you can't take, with comics, everything has to be done at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You can't take a manuscript like you would, and those editors in publishing houses are not used to that because, again, they've got a paragraph of text or even a manuscript, and then they can edit it or make suggestions, and it's still malleable. Comics are not malleable that way. You don't hand in a book and then have your editor say, well, why don't we have this sequence come sooner in the book?
It's kind of late.
It's too late, yes. It's really too late. Like, but you know, all the artists that I work with were willing. We didn't do this kind of editing, just to answer your prior question, we didn't do this kind of editing with Little Lit because, again, we had different goals at mm-hmm. the time. With Little Lit, we actually function more like, in a way that was more similar to the way we did in Raw, which mm-hmm. is that we, you know, we certainly had an editorial input in terms of which artist and what the overall gist of the story was, and how many pages we gave each to tell the stories, and we did a rough edit on the breakdowns, more with some artists than with others. I mean, when we worked with cartoonists, we didn't need to. When we worked with children's book artists, we had to be more hands-on to get them to do comics that flowed well. And with the Toon books, again, they're in a different parallel, but different purpose than what we were doing with Little Lit.
I'm going to take a quick 2-minute break.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to play the Jiminy Cricket song.
Great.
I was able to track it down. And then I want to ask some questions about the artists, because we're talking about the process, and I'm fascinated by some of the artists that you've chosen for this project.
So, look forward to it.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
See, now, where was I? Oh, yes. About the human animal.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read. The cow goes moo, and the dog goes ruff. The cat meows, and the horse kicks up his hoof.
And so the only human animal is you, you, you. You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
The pig goes oink, and the mule, ee-honk. The duck goes quack, and the sheep, eh-eh-eh.
And so the only human animal is you, you, you.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
The chick goes quack, and the coyote, no. The birds tweet, tweet, and the fish goes.
And so the only human animal is you, you, you.
Did you know that singing can make work more fun?
I know, it makes my life more fun. CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Ink Studs Show, a radio show where we talk about comics just to let people know what's going on in the Ink Studs right now. Throughout the month of March, we're doing a focus on women in comics in recognition of International Women's Day, March 8th, this Saturday. And so all month we'll be interviewing women as well. Online, we'll have interviews with young women doing small press stuff who really blow me away with their comics. I forgot to introduce earlier, and I've been scolded for such, my co-host Robin Constabaris. Thank you for coming, Robin.
Oh,
please,
you're
don't
welcome,
hate me.
Robin.
And our special guest today is Françoise Mouly. Did I get it right?
Yes, you did.
The reason I'm like so like, I always mispronounce names. It's horrible. I'll be like interviewing someone and somehow I'll get their name like three different ways. So I'm like,
well,
I
know,
gotta get
really
it right today.
It really doesn't bother me. I'm delighted to be here. You can pronounce my name anyway.
I refuse. I'm gonna get it right.
Françoise, I was wondering when you were talking about going through the process of bringing the comics to the kids to get their feedback or see how they responded to the comics, if that process brought any fresh perspective to you or you learned anything new about the medium of comics?
So much. Yeah, no, really so much. It was really fascinating. I've you know, edited and published comics all my life. And one thing that I found out is doing comics for children is actually the essence of what I've been doing up until now. It really forces you to go to the core of what the medium can accomplish. It's interesting because in a parallel way, the same way that, you know, a cartoon is a reduction of the essential lines in someone's face, a way of, like, the most meaningful elements. Similarly, when you do something for children, because you can't make assumptions about, like, oh, well, they'll have read the Iliad or they'll know exactly what, you know, this reference to King Arthur refers to, you have to let everything be crystal clear, self-contained, and this was really like an amazing lesson to me, because I thought, you know, I was doing this to make good use of my skills. I didn't realize that it would be such a learning curve, and that I would acquire so much more, so many new skills. And then there's plenty of things. You know, I totally fell in love with all the teachers and the educators and the librarians that I'm in touch with, because, oh my God,
the
oh
passion
God,
they have.
What an endeavor. What a task. And especially nowadays. I mean, the combination of the lack of respect, money, means that teachers have to contend with the scope of the task, because they are, I mean, they're saving those kids. They really are. The kids, like...
Yeah.
You know, come from it's from homes where there are no books, and no magazines for that matter, and no newspapers, and no computers. And in schools, they encounter all of this. And there's so many things that I learned. Like one of them, which was really a total discovery, is kids love reading. I mean, they really do. That's the one thing in schools that they look forward to, that's universally anticipated, because story hour for the first grade or two means being read to. And if you have any spare time on your hands, just go to a school, like, volunteer to read. They love being read to one-on-one. They love being read to by the teachers. They love stories. They love to talk about the stories. I learned all those things from I mean, all the teachers I talked to like put it in words, but one of the I learned a lot about boys and girls. I mean, having had a boy and a girl, I realized that no matter what I thought when I was myself a kid, it's not all the same. There are differences. and, you know, you learn that very quickly when your kid is in kindergarten and so on, and they start differentiating. And, you know, broadly speaking, boys learn differently than girls and so on. And the educators were talking specifically about the big attraction that comics represent for boys. We tend to be more visual. For whom the visual narrative is meaningful, it corresponds more to their interest. And it reminded me of, you know, my little boy going on for hours and hours, like, you know, telling me this narrative of, like, and then he went over there, and then he hit his and then he did this. That was his action figures. I mean, it's all descriptions of action, whereas girls are more interested in dialogue. But the long and short of it was there's so many ways in which this very simple idea, doing comics for kids, became so rich as I was doing it. It's like, oh, but of course. You know, if done correctly, and doing, delivering to kids works that had the lasting power of works of art or works of literature, because the other thing that happens is that when a child, a young child, was so eager to... I'm sorry, this is like falling all over myself because, yes, your question is, God, do I have an answer for this?
That's excellent.
I learned so much, but one of the things I learned is, in a way that I hadn't perceived as a parent, I had to realize it when I was, you know, specifically doing something for a kid at that point. What the child wants is order. They really want, you know, they're perceiving everything that's happening around them. They want structure, and literature and reading is a structure. It's a way to think about things inwards. And the great thing about books compared to a video game is the fact that you can go back to it and you can turn the pages and you can reread. And as a matter of fact, kids, when you read them a book, and they like that book, they want it read over and over and over and over again. They know it by heart. They still want you to read it to them. They're reading it to themselves. And it answers a very deep need of nomenclature, structure, hierarchy, story narrative, and deep, something that's a reliable thing that will happen over and over again. And the great thing about a book is because you make the story happen in your head, it's a way to actually both use your imagination and to use it in a way where you feel yourself telling the story in your head. I was just reading something, a quote from somebody who was... the person who invented Dungeons and Dragons died
at
his
orbit
yesterday. And the last quote in his orbit is that he's asking kids whether they liked radio or television better. And one kid was saying that he liked radio better, and he asked twice, oh, because the pictures are so much better.
Oh, that's
wonderful.
Yeah. That's great, isn't it? But that's exactly what we're talking about. And with comics, the pictures are so much better than they are in a video game or in a movie specifically. And one of the symptomatic... I mean, one of the ways that we see this is, I'm in touch with Michael Bitz, who does a comic book project at Teachers College.
Mm-hmm.
and is capitalizing on the fact that when a kid gets into a comic and it becomes a meaningful book for them, one of the feelings that they get right away is like, oh, I want to do this. I want to make a comic. And they want to become authors and write their own stories. Obviously, it's not going to happen at 6 years old, but it does happen 7, 8 years old. But it doesn't happen with video games, that when they get really into a video game, they want to invent one because that feels too alien. Whereas with a comic, they do perceive it's the handwriting of the artist. They realize that one person did it.
And that's actually something interesting doing the show for so long now, is like a lot of cartoonists started out doing, as a kid, their own comic work, you know, as subpar in quality may have been at a young age, it's still that chance to really express themselves and find a way of doing a voice where you don't have to get as complex as writing a story, where you can kind of visualize your imagination.
Yeah, I mean, it has this, you know, it's a razor's edge where it's both done by somebody, but because you're completing the circle when you're reading it, because it's happening in your head, you're also a genuine reader of this. It's a back and forth that is incredibly attractive to the kids because they are eager to structure their own stories. And I think that's part of the reason why they adopt the stories that they read in the comics, because it really is very evocative for them. It's a way to put a lot of the thoughts that would otherwise remain chaotic.
Even myself growing up, like I mentioned before, the Asterix as a young man, and finding other, at a older age, pre-adolescence, finding comics were very interesting as far as being able to get into something, not necessarily wanting to get into full novels, but being able to engage a different level.
Such an anomaly, because my first love of comics was Raw. So thank you, Francoise.
Well, you know, that's so nice to hear, Robin. Yeah. But this is an interesting recent development. But then I'm now... I'm like 53 years old, so in my old age, I'm running into people who've discovered comics as adults. That wasn't the case. It's only when we were doing Raw. Almost everybody that was interested in the medium had encountered it as a kid. Well, first of all, because there weren't such a thing as comics for grown-ups or independent comic publishing or graphic novel, for that matter. But the shift, I think, is wonderful because, for one thing, it has included women. And I think that was not just a good thing, but an absolutely necessary thing. And there's no... I do understand, after having spent 30 years in this country, that superhero comics can appeal to the 9 to 12-year-old boy. It's undeniable. And sure, but that shouldn't just be the only possible incarnation of the medium. Well, and even before manga, which has been a way for letting little girls into the medium, it's also interesting to see the broadening that happens as soon as you have women cartoonists. And one of the things that I'm finding out now that I'm publishing children's book is the world of books, publishing, reading, and certainly books for children, is very predominantly women. A lot of them have not had good prejudices about comics. You know, they think of it as like for the retarded boys or something. Well, they do.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
I mean, you know, when I'm talking to the superintendent of school in Maryland, Nancy Grasmick, and we are setting our books to be read in the schools of Maryland. Which is great, and also talking with various other teachers, I'll tell you, the teachers who use comics in the classroom and who are making this happen are almost always the 3 or 4% male colleagues that most teachers have. But I'm also running into phenomenal young women who've just discovered comics as adults, like one of the main person I talked to at Diamond with our distributor is Jenna Morishima, and she was an editor in the book world. But she really is an example of a person that didn't grow up reading comics, discovered them as a young college-age adult, and is passionately trying to, you know, set things up so that there could be more and broader range of comics published. It's very exciting. We're yeah. really at the juncture now where our deep little secret about wonderful and great comics are and all of the different things we can do is finally getting an airing.
Kind of a mini segue is one of the things I'm really excited about as in the line of books in the fall 2008 releases is you have a book coming up from Eleanor Davis,
yes.
who is one of my favorite young women doing comics right now. She's like fantastic, and I saw that she was doing, you know.
This is actually talk about, you know, young women, bright young women becoming cartoonists. Eleanor is 23 or 24 maybe now, but she was 22 or 23 when she started the book, the Toon book, Stinky it's called. And this will be her first published book. It's coming out in the fall. She's someone who grew up with two parents who were teachers and going to an alternative school. She was still in school herself when she started doing the Toon books. Her book is absolutely fantastic. They all are, but
yeah.
It's hard to explain that this is the first book by someone and the first children's book is so masterful.
Well, I have some of her mini comics, and they're just fantastic. They're just the quality, the craftsmanship that's gone into it. So seeing that recognition puts a warm spot in my
yeah,
heart.
Yeah, and she is an example of somebody who wasn't even a gleam in their parents' eye when I was doing Rose. So she has grown up with the reality of Rose first and then Chris Ware and then Drawn and Quarterly. And, you know, by the time she's a teenager and a young adult, like, serious comics are a matter of course. And when she decides to be a cartoonist, that's not a counterculture move anymore. It's a possible mm-hmm. thing to do, and it bodes very well for the future. One thing that I think a lot of people don't seem to realize is how hard it is to do comics. They think in many of the mainstream publishing house. They think, like, oh, you know what, I'll do a line of, like, 20 books, and then we'll just hire some writers and artists, and, you know, then next year, well, 2 years. In 2 years, we'll have our 20 books ready. It's like, wait. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah, comics have to be the most isolating profession.
They're so labor-intensive.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and they require people. Because, I mean, yes, you can do the assembly line version of it, but that's certainly not what I'm interested
in. That's just a factory product. It's
yeah,
just graphic design and story format, really.
Yeah, yeah. I think in many ways, stories are repetitive. And there's room for this. So, you know, I'm not a snob and saying, like, you know, my stuff better than their stuff. Like,
it just doesn't interest
you. Just about everything. Their stuff being that, like, you know, the superior Marvel, DC, or the genre
mm-hmm.
Work in comics. It's not a matter of ranking that one is better than others. They fulfill different functions. Like, I had no problem when my children, both of them, actually, read series books. Like, my daughter got into the Goosebumps, and then my son got into... No, I think he got into the Goosebumps, and she was into the Babysitter's Club. You know, you hold your nose, and you let it go for a year and a half, because they're reading, like, a book every other two a week or something, and it's the same damn story over and over and over again with the same characters, and it's completely trashy, badly written, cost $2.99, but that's fine.
They're reading. They're enjoying it.
Oh, they are reading, and they are into the book, and they like the fact that it repeats. It's another version of watching the same movie over and over and over again that both my kids did when they were 3 or 4 years old, reading the same book over and over and over again. It's fine for, 8 to 12-year-old boys to read the same, Battle of Titans week after week. It's not an issue, as long as it doesn't become the only way things can get done.
And even comics themselves sometimes get so steeped in recurring themes, even in the most alternative, it can be
very
repetitive.
There's so many, no matter... One of the virtues of comics being so difficult to do and so time-consuming, as you were saying, is it's unlikely that an artist and for very little reward will spend 3 years just telling a raw story.
Mm-hmm.
So for the most part, people will sit down and will do their own book, take the time to find a story worth telling because they're going to have to live with it
sort of
day in and day out and draw every panel of it.
Self-filtering.
Exactly.
I've interviewed some cartoonists who have problems working on their own graphic novel because it's so confining. I guess it's just working on that process and that
bit
like,
of a
years,
navel gaze.
It is. We unfortunately were at the end of our timeline here. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
When do the books come out? I understand they're all coming out the same date.
Now, which is next month, beginning of April.
Excellent.
And I'm asking that same question of Diamond, who's our distributor. And, they should arrive. Evidently, we made some kind of faux pas in terms of which previews issue we were in, and then we moved in the public because there's actually a lot of interest. But sometime April, May, June, by the summer, they should be available both in comic stores and in regular stores.
And that'll be Benny and Penny.
It's three books in the spring, three books in the fall. So in the spring, it's Benny and Penny by Jeffrey Hayes, Silly Lily by a French cartoonist named Agnès Rosenstiel, and Odo's Orange Day by Frank Camusso and Jay Lynch. And in the fall, we're publishing Stinky by Eleanor Davis, Mo and Joe by Dean Haspel and Jay Lynch, and Jack in the Box by Art Spiegelman.
I was really fascinated to see that Jay Lynch is involved because, my first thought of Jay Lynch is Bijou Funnies.
But, Jay is actually one of Art's oldest friends because they met when they were 16 and I think Art was 14 or something, and they were doing fanzines. They both loved Mad Magazine and Kurtzman. They both have worked for Tops, so I knew of Jay's real knack for doing great stuff for kids.
Fantastic cartoonist.
So he's really, really good, and Frank... This is an instance where they're both cartoonists, they both work together, and Frank is a terrific cartoonist, we put them on doing another Otto book. The book is so fabulous, so that will come out the year after.
I look forward to seeing them.
Okay.
And it sounds like excellent stuff. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Have a wonderful evening.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye. That was Francoise Moulet talking to us about Toon Books. This stuff looks great.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing these books.
Thank you so much for taking an hour out of your day. I'm now officially over time. The guys are standing outside staring at me. Don't forget, Saturday, International Women's Day. do something empowering for women.
And don't forget, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
Up next is Crimes and Treasons. Thank you all. And next week, we'll be good.
Particle man, doing the things a particle can. What's he like? It's not important. Particle man, is he a dot or is he a speck? When he's underwater, does he get wet? Or does the water get him instead? Nobody knows. Particle man. Triangle man, triangle man. Triangle man hates particle man. They have a fight. Triangle wins. Triangle man. Universe man, size of the entire universe man, usually kind to smaller man. Universe man, he's got a watch with a minute hand, millennium hand, energy on hand. And when they meet, it's a happy land. Powerful man, universe man. Person man, hit on the head with a frying pan, lives his life in a garbage can. Person man, is he depressed or is he a mess? Does he feel totally worthless? Who came up with person man? Degraded man, person man. Triangle man, triangle man hates person man. They have a fight.